Now I want to talk about Silmarillion, the Silmarillion Film Project. Okay. Welcome, guys.
Good evening, Corey.
Good evening. Okay, here we go. There's Marie. So you guys want to... Are you guys webcamable? We've got Trish and Nick and Dave here with me. Also,
I'm going to be the disembodied voice because if I tried to put my video up, I think my internet would have a coronary.
Right, no problem. Yeah, that is it is hard sometimes. We don't want to slow your internet down too much.
Apparently, I'm going to be horribly backlit.
That's all right. That's right. Nick, are you webcamable, Nick? I know you were maybe dealing with a shaky internet connection tonight too.
Nick, your microphone showing is self-muted.
Yeah, yeah.
So if you're talking,
just
oh, there you go. Might be a problem. There
okay.
we go.
Excellent.
Okay. So anyway, yeah. So I'm on the road, but the internet connection issue was solved, but not the machine to actually webcam from.
I see. Right. Okay. Right. So yeah, we caught Nick traveling. Okay. So all right. So we will stick with this then. Very good. Very good. So we'll get you two. We'll get Trish. Good to hear your voice again. We've been missing you our last two sessions on Silmarillion. We're sorry
you
haven't been able to make it.
It's been such a bummer. Like I said in my last one yesterday when I said I couldn't make it, I said at least this is a really long running show.
So yes.
Missing two in a row is like not even going to be a big deal.
it'll be a very small percentage at the end of the day.
Right. You know, the good news is that we still haven't managed to actually get to episode 3.
Yeah, you still haven't missed episode 3.
We've been also quite behind. We haven't actually done anything since episode 1. So
there you go. Oh, there you go. So see, you're right on pace. You're right on pace. That's great.
Yeah, it's you know, it's shades of Silmarillion seminar and the one more
week. Shit. Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, the Silmarillion Film Project is, I think, one of the most, no, it's really the most unusual and unorthodox of all of the Mythgard programs. You know, most of the rest of the stuff that I'm doing is fairly simple, right? It's, fundamentally, it's just like, let's just talk about the books in a like some kind of comparatively straightforward way. Even my LOTRO streams are kind of like that. It's just when I'm doing the LOTRO streams, it's like, let's just focus the discussion of Tolkien's books on, you know, the interaction with the LOTRO world that I happen to be in at that point. Silmarillion Film Project is different. I have been... ever since we thought of the concept of the Silmarillion Film Project, I've been really, really excited about it. And this started really back in Riddles in the Dark when we were talking about the Hobbit films, right, Dave? So essentially, yep. Silmfilm is just us taking matters into our own hands, essentially, right?
Yep.
More proactive,
exactly, because we spent so much time thinking about the kind of adaptation challenges that Peter Jackson was facing in making the Hobbit movies and, you know, the kinds of things that we hoped he did or we thought he might do or whatever, sort of speculating both about what we thought would be awesome and about what we thought he would actually do. And of course the reality fell so far short of our own vision for what the Hobbit films could have been that we just decided to just kind of cut that out of the way and do it ourselves.
Yes, that
Silmarillion was actually our answer to Peter Jackson's unsaid question of, so do you think you can do it better yourself? Then you try.
Yeah, that's right. That was always the frustrating part about Riddles in the Dark was the constraints and both the constraints and the dissatisfaction of reality failing to deliver on our vision.
Yes. Right.
And it's worth noting that... that during the course of for people who are watching this who didn't get a chance to listen to Riddles in the Dark, this isn't sort of the typical Tolkien fan, like, you know, oh, we're just snottily turning our noses up because Peter Jackson refused to directly adapt the book in a faithful manner the way we think, blah 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 blah. We actually during the course of Riddles in the Dark, we were we bought into the idea of adaptation and like making changes to that were better suited to the medium. We were totally down with it. So our frustration was not the usual, like, you know, I don't like what they did to Aragorn's character type frustration. Rather, it was like we had this great picture in our mind of how interesting The Hobbit could be once adapted to the screen. And then the actual adaptation turned out to be way less interesting than we thought it could be.
Yeah, exactly. And of course, after The Hobbit, everybody's talking about The Silmarillion, right? Like, okay, so Peter Jackson, when are you going to do The Silmarillion? Of course, to which the answer is, which even Peter Jackson is too polite to give, not until Christopher Tolkien is dead. So that's, you know, while Christopher Tolkien draws breath, that's not going to happen. Which is fine.
75 years,
we hope. Yeah, exactly. Long life to Christopher Tolkien. But so the fundamental concept of the Silmarillion film project is, like with Riddles of the Dark, again, you know, as Dave said, the way we went through, we were doing neither of the two things that often like a Tolkien podcast talking about the Hobbit films might have done, right? We were neither, as Dave said, being sort of snootily intellectual and looking down upon their enterprise, nor were we just like, you know, being movie fans and talking about like what is Richard Armitage doing and how dreamy is he? You know, we were neither just like sort of getting excited about the films for the sake of being excited about the films. And I know, sorry, Maria, I was perhaps a little close to home there. The point is, you know, we were trying to engage with it, sort of accepting it for what it was and thinking it through and thinking through what are the challenges, like approaching the story ourselves and saying, given what happens in The Hobbit and its relationship with the Lord of the Rings, what's going to be interesting? What's going to be challenging about these decisions that they make? We decided to just move ahead and start our own Silmarillion adaptation, mostly because we were so confident that it could never possibly be made. So that makes it safe, right? and we figured that even if we went slowly, we wouldn't so long as Christopher Tolkien remains in good health, we would not have to worry about any actualization overtaking our purely theoretical enterprise. So we started this project saying, let's think through the Silmarillion. Our fundamental premise was, obviously, we're not going to do a film adaptation, like a feature film adaptation, because the Silmarillion as a story type is just very poorly adapted to that kind of thing. That would be silly. There are some stories that would work well as feature films. Beren and Lúthien could make a great feature film. Túrin Túrinbar would make a very depressing but very good feature film, if done well. But Silmarillion as a whole, not really so much. So we decided, let's do this as a long-running TV show. So let's do this like Game of Thrones style, essentially, though with less nudity. So we were like, okay, so that's what we're going to do.
And way less incest.
Yes.
Not completely incest, but way more death.
Right. More death. Yes. Well, at least rivaling the death.
Also,
anyways,
more geography.
More geography.
Yeah, right.
Exactly. Right. Exactly. I still, of course, one of our jokes is that season four is going to be, like, more than half of season four is going to be the dramatic interpretation of Beleriand and its realms, which is going to be an awesome season.
One of these days you're going to notice that season four does cover almost 500 years of history.
I know, exactly. Exactly, yeah. No, there's going
to
be plenty.
Which is why some of us are trying to push for all of season four to be of Beleriand
and its realms. Yeah, exactly. We're going to have to split that up. We can't possibly rush our way through of Beleriand and its realms as fast as that. But anyway, no. So, Brandon, we're not talking about an episode based on a Beleriand and its realms. We're talking about like 8 episodes or 10 episodes, possibly an entire 13 episode season of Beleriand and its realms. So like, what's the point of this, right? Why do we do this? What do we take from doing this? And, you know, the thing that has been just remarkable to me is as you start thinking through adaptation, as you begin thinking about storytelling within the frame of what, you know, given what we get in the Silmarillion and thinking as we've often done, you know, comparing, bringing stuff in from like the Book of Lost Tales and other places, you know, sometimes we choose elements from those that we really want to keep or bring back that Tolkien took out. in thinking these things through, what are some things that we see? There are so many places where the story, it challenges us to think about the story in new ways that we, you know, just really never thought before. For me, that's I have learned so much about the Silmarillion. You know, the Silmarillion seminar will always be, you know, in the Hall of Fame of, you know, the stuff that I've done, and certainly one of the most experiences of my life, really. But I think I've learned more about the Silmarillion from the Silmarillion Film Project so far than I did in the Silmarillion seminar, because it forces us to invest imaginatively. The tone of the Silmarillion, right? It's so distant so much of the time. It gives most of the Silmarillion is giving a pretty broad overview of what happened. Sometimes we get in and we get to close up to really compelling stories. And it's, you know, it's still, even when it's far away, it's still very powerful, very powerful invocation of mythic ideas that are very moving to think about. But when you're actually thinking about, you know, the act sort of coming in down alongside the character, what are these people like? You know, and asking these questions forces us to sort of recognize, goodness, I don't know anything about half of these people. You know, we don't know what they did or what they said. There's so much that we don't know. And that has been really interesting to sort of discover and think about the situations that Tolkien described and what he sort of actually suggested. I think it's been an amazing experience. I'd love to hear from you guys. What are some moments that have really jumped out at you, places where you really sort of learned a lot or felt like you had your eyes opened about something from the Silmarillion story and in the discussions we've been having?
I thought I'd let Marie or Nick go first.
Okay. I personally enjoy having the opportunity to talk about the Silmarillion with anybody ever. So that's always great. But as far as particular parts of the adaptation, I never really had a good sense of the geography of Valinor. Like what's where, mm-hmm. And how that impacted the story until we had to actually make things happen in different places in Valinor in season two.
Yes.
And then I had to figure out that, you know, Valmar is the city on the plain. So it's, you know, a flat city.
Right.
That's going to matter as to how you envision it and what it looks like different than, the mountain to Nequitil, obviously totally different. Mm-hmm. Geography to it.
Yeah.
And what you can see from different places, like how do you see the trees and if you're not right next to them? You know, if you're at Formenos, is it darker there? Does it look different? Tyrion, right. Like all the windows face towards the trees because that's where the light is. You know, just things like that that I hadn't really ever thought about just reading the story. But when you try to make events happen and characters experiencing it, you have to kind of place it a little bit more.
Yes.
Solidly, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean, a lot of these things are, Marie, many of the issues that you're describing right there are issues that visual artists grapple with, right, when they try to depict these things. But it's so easy to just kind of read over it, right? You just kind of accept the fact, like, okay, you know, the tree is illumined Valinor. Great. Okay. And then you just kind of move on without really thinking about, what would it have been like to live in Valmar? What was that experience? What must that have looked like? Cool. Other thoughts? Nick, Trish, Dave?
Well, for me, some of the most amazing things has been delving into the individual characters.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, because we have to show them, we have to show how they get to where they are at any given moment. You know, you have to show the changes in the way that a person thinks when they move from point A to point B, personality-wise.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the Fingolfin, for all the conflict that arose over that, I think that the character of Fingolfin was a good study of that.
Yeah.
Because the very first thing that Tolkien says about Fingolfin as a person is that he's proud. You know, he lumps him right in there with Feanor. It's in the same sentence. And I had never really picked up on that until we were, and here I was
fighting to maintain the glorious image of Fingolfin, right? And then I realized, no, wait, this is a flawed guy right there in the text. Mm-hmm. You know, and maybe we don't need to have this, you know, simpering younger son figure, but we can certainly address the fact that he's got his own issues, and right. some of them, and part of the problem is that he and Feanor are quite a lot alike.
Right, right. Yeah, yeah. No, there have been a bunch of things, a bunch of moments like that, a bunch of times when characters, even characters like Fingolfin that you think you know, right? When you're really paying attention, like, what does it say about them? What kinds of situations are they put in? Even just, again, those times when this sort of overall, like, distant from the events plot summary thing that he does in The Silmarillion, which just tells us that this thing happened, right? But you can kind of accept that as an event, right? Even think about that, you know, and kind of feel the significance of it from a mythic standpoint without really bringing yourself down and imagining what must it have been like? What does it say about this guy, you know, that he did this and said this? How would that actually have worked? It's very interesting to think about. Trish, how about you? Oh, sorry. Well. Yeah, you want to second that one as well?
Yeah, that's one of the ones I was thinking about. That's a nice example where, in attempting to flesh out the characters and figure out sort of how to portray, not just portray them, but portray the relationships and the events mm-hmm. around them in sort of a way that will be satisfying on the screen, you find that that there's layers to those characters that you hadn't previously noticed, mm-hmm. especially in The Silmarillion, where it's very easy to read these characters as kind of mythic and, dare I say, one-dimensional characters. So, and I think, you know, there's a little bit of it that's adaptation, but that's some of it is imaginative, where we're saying, like, oh, let's, you know, we would like to have some drama here, or the way it's portrayed in the book sort of simplistically doesn't make sense. But as Nick pointed out, oftentimes the things that we're innovating on are grounded in a close reading of the actual text. So,
right.
So yeah, I think the Fingolfin Feanor dynamic being a little more complicated than one might get from a cursory reading of the text is one of the really interesting examples, and one of the ones that was very satisfying to work on.
Yeah, because you're right. There's a lot of stuff that we're innovating, but it's not just about, like, let's make up a bunch of random stuff, right? It's not about, like, we need to jazz this plot up a little bit. Let's include a love interest.
I know.
Sandworms. Yay. Let's add sandworms. Yeah, exactly. And it's not about, let's dig around
Bob Way.
There was Bob Way, but that was just a joke. He's not actually in the script.
Sandworms in the War to Begin All Wars for... first season?
We didn't do sandworms. We did have monsters, right? Because it does say there are monsters, right?
Yeah. We did have like squids and like all kinds of crazy things. So
because we didn't have orcs, right? We have a war, but no orcs, so we have to do something, right? But that's exactly an illustration of what we're just talking about, right? It's not about saying, hey, let's just make stuff up to jazz this up a little bit. It's given what the text says, what would have to be in order to make that happen? Who are they fighting? Who's the war against? And so we need to, because there are no orcs, which is, of course, normally whom people are fighting against. That's been fun.
You're gonna get to see how brilliant I am.
Okay.
Ready?
Excellent.
Since I'm the last one. What everybody said, I totally agree with. See, so I get all of those. Plus, I get another one. One of the things that's been really, really fun for me is the bad guys. Mm-hmm. Because we stated very early on, it's like, this is not a black and white thing. We're not going black and white. Melkor does not start out evil.
Yes.
Sauron does not start out evil.
Yes.
And so weaving that story and tracking and tracing their falls in a way that's both believable and is good storytelling has been really interesting to me. And it, you know, it again, it goes in, you know, it makes us have to go deeper into the story. I mean, I don't think I'll ever now even read Lord of the Rings again without thinking in terms of what Sauron once was.
Yes.
As a result of us doing this exercise.
Yes.
That was also on my list, Trish.
Twins separated at birth. What can I tell you?
All of the scenes with Myron have been fascinating. What's Myron doing over in Middle Earth while?
What would he be thinking? What's his motivation? What's his?
He has to be doing something. He's there. He has to be thinking. Like, something has to be happening. We have to come up with something. But what is it? And that's not covered in the text at all.
And even Ungoliant. You know, we really developed Ungoliant as a character from two legs. Yeah. You know, I mean, in other words, like, well, where did she come from? Well, she must have been a Maya, right? And how would that have worked? And what would be her... So, yeah, it's been really, really fun that way. But all the other stuff everybody else said, too, has been pretty awesome. Well, and we've been contending with the whole issue of, like, death and it, with the elves, you know, and especially having...
Oh, yeah.
I've lost the last two episodes, but the kinslaying, you know, and I know we got into a lot of conversation about that and what would that be like. And I think we really raised this issue of, you know what, as Tolkien always kind of implied, way different view of it from the elves because of their nature than man, you know, and it's been really, it's been really interesting.
And nailing that down is actually really hard.
Yeah.
And it's not like Tolkien provides a clear answer anyway in the texts and his letters, etc. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, exactly. I mean, that conversation is one of the things that I was really thinking about, our kinslaying conversation, you know, so many things that, you know, thinking about the, like, I've been thinking about the kinslaying entirely differently because I never asked the question, you know, okay. Like, yeah. Given that it's sad and tragic and a really bad idea to have done. Right. But nevertheless, like what was going on to the elves at the kinslaying? Like when an elf is standing over the dead body of his or her relative, what are they experiencing exactly? It's not, you know, there are several points in the text where if we assume that elves think the same way people do, humans do, we're kind of pulled up short about that, right? It's not, it's different. And one of the fundamental things that Tolkien opened up in his, you know, in making his stories into fundamentally, there are other races as well, but basically a sort of a two race question, right? Let's look at the mortals and let's look at the immortals. We have both the mortals and the immortals. What is this about their interactions, the way that they look at the world and how, you know, what would it mean to be immortal in the way that the elves are immortal, right? Which is a particular kind of immortality. And I'd never applied that to the kinslaying. And I realized as we were planning the kinslaying, the picture I always had in my head when I imagined the Teleri, you know, at the kinslaying, you know, the living ones, not the dead ones, was basically them all reacting like humans, right? Them all, you know, weeping and mourning exactly like a human being might weep and mourn over their dead relatives. But death means something different to them. So I totally didn't regret spending almost an entire episode talking about that and never getting to the episode we were supposed to be discussing.
Actually, later in season 55, when we get to Beren and Luthien, and, you know, they have to contend with Luthien making her decision.
Yes.
That's going to be interesting. You know, like, we now have this, you know, we've informed ourselves sort of so that changes that whole thing for me, too, later
Absolutely.
On down the line.
Absolutely,
because of this, you know, I don't think they're going to be able to get their heads around it for a while. But anyway, we'll get to that in season 55.
Yeah, exactly. That conversation with the kinslaying is totally going to pay dividends when we get around to Beren and Luthien at the end. And even, I mean, because, you know, we talked in that context also of the scene at the end of the Lord of the Rings, right? When Elrond, you know, the big deal that the narrator makes of the parting between Elrond and Arwen, right? And why that is such a big, you know, that's that there's a sense in which that moment when Elrond and Arwen say goodbye, you know, up in the hills, that's a bigger deal than the kinslaying. In a very significant way, you know, that to Elrond, he's more upset, has more reason to be upset than, you know, a random Teleri who is standing in the midst of you know, her slaughtered family.
But I'll tell you what else, even before that, is I'm going to be really interested when we get to the part where Elros and Elrond have to make their choices. And what, because Elrond's going to have experience, I assume that they're twins. I've always assumed they've been close. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I don't think Tolkien actually specifically says that,
right.
But I assume they're close because they're twin brothers, right? And I've always wondered about that. You know, it's like, how did that affect Elrond? Of course, you know, I mean, I did a paper on, is there anybody sadder in Middle-earth than Elrond for all the losses he sustained?
Right.
You know?
Right.
But anyway, so yeah, so that'll be a little earlier than the Arwen and Elrond one. Yeah. You know, in the show.
You would have liked the reading of the pilot script then, because there actually is a scene in there with Elrond and Elros.
Oh, awesome. Awesome.
Oh, yeah, the pilot script that we read.
Yep.
At Mythmoot, yeah. Yeah, cool. Excellent. Okay. Neat. Yeah, so no, it has been a really fun process, and you know, so I hope that, I mean, obviously there's a lot of you know, creative fun involved. It's been really cool the way that the community has really been growing and responding. Seeing the work that visual artists and composers and of course our script writing team and you know, lots of other people are doing. The pre-production and post-production episodes are always really fun as we're going through the concepts that people have come up with, thinking about designs and how this would work.
The casting
discussion has been very interesting.
Scores and soundtracks.
Yeah. So, as you know, all of these ways for, and again, you know, in one way, you know, one of my goals for the Silmarillion project was just to, you know, because I know one of the struggles that a lot of people have with the Silmarillion is just not being able to invest themselves, their imagination in it, right? To sort of, you know, the reaction that so many people have that they read the Silmarillion and to them, it's just like a list of names. You know, it's like, this is just, you know, like something to memorize, not something to like lose yourself in. So helping people to get into that process of investing themselves imaginatively in the Silmarillion story was my initial goal to the whole thing. And it's gone so far beyond that. The level of engagement that people have been doing has been really, really wonderful. I love the scores, Philip Menzies' music that he's been composing. He's been working on themes for different concepts and different, like, you know, different themes for the different Valar and different, like, recurring themes that play when a fall is going on or something like that. It's been really neat to see him.
He even did Bobway's theme.
Yeah, he did do Bobway's theme. Right. So if you're wondering who Bobway is an inside joke. It's an inside joke from the beginning of season two, actually. So, yeah.
Don't let Corey mislead you. He's a central character.
The central character, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Well, actually, yeah, he got lost, right? Because what it was we were talking about the three elf emissaries that go over to Valinor. And Dave said, you know, we ought to have a red shirt elf
right
with them that gets lost. And I said, yeah, he'd be Bobway. And I just, it grew legs. What can I tell you?
Yeah.
It just grew legs. And so ever since then. So actually, I created an elf in Lotro named Bobway.
Named Bobway, yeah.
And Phil wrote the theme for Bobway and made it into an ABC file so I could play it. And one night when we were doing a kinship thing and Corey was on weekends, you know, like, and I just walked out as Bobway.
As Bobway and started playing the song.
And he's wearing red, of course.
Yes, so, exactly.
But now the poor guy is my storage elf. So he just basically stays at the house and handles all the storage stuff I send him. So,
yeah.
Poor guy.
Yeah.
Anyway, but I was going to say, you know, for anybody who's listening or watching this, listening to this now or later, and it's like, oh, Silmarillion, geez, you know, I don't know. I have a few things to say to that. One is, if you start with this film project, you're safe because what? We didn't go through all the way through chapter one for what? A season and a half?
Yeah, we spent almost a season on the first chapter. Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah. Our whole first season deals with very, like, only the first few pages, basically, of the Silmarillion. So you can go really super slow. And then it's also, I think, really interesting. But the other is a Silmarillion seminar that Corey mentioned, which is invaluable. I think, for anybody that seriously wants to read the Silmarillion, because you're talking about not just Corey, who knows the Silmarillion, but folks who are studying sort of along with you, if you will, you know, and asking questions that you would ask. The other one is, if you're just interested in, like, the artwork Corey's talking about and the conversations and stuff, is go to the forum. You don't have to even watch the show or listen to the show. Silmfilm.mythgard.org. Is it Mythgard, right, still? Silmfilm.mythgard.org is the forum, and it's all there. I mean, the whole community is there, and it's great.
No, the forums are really the heart of the Silmarillion Film Project, where, you know, we do our shows, our biweekly shows, talking our way through things. But the real work is all happening on the discussion forums. You know, that's where you can join in and
that's
participate.
Very true.
Yeah,
that is where all the real work is happening.
Executive producer, so we just get to sit. You know, we stay at high level.
Take credit.
We veto.
We take credit.
Yeah, take credit.
Take credit. Make their lives harder. Yeah, go ahead.
It's really neat that it is such a collaborative project that people can throw in their two cents and come up with ideas of how to address certain challenges in the story.
Yeah.
Because expecting one person to solve all the creative issues is a little bit much. So. Mm-hmm.
Definitely.
Right. Yeah, we have, and I mean, we're talking folks all over the world too, you know, that are weighing in on this, which is really cool. And I remember, Corey, you saying that when we first started this out, you were hoping that this is what would happen. And here we are.
Here we are.
Look at that. Here
absolutely.
We are.
He's regretted those
job
words ever since.
Exactly. Exactly. Very good. So yeah, we're projecting forward to at least 20 seasons at this point. At least 20 seasons to get to the end of the Lord of the Rings, I think. To go from the Ainulindale to the Grey Havens, basically. That's maybe more. Yep. But
And then the spin-offs of the Sons of Durin and the House of Aerol are, you know.
That's right. And the further adventures of Aragorn and Éomer as they go clean up Middle Earth.
That's right.
After.
Absolutely.
That's right.
Yeah.
Cool.
But one of the things that's been the most interesting for me, and
Wally!
The point,
I got completely distracted.
there was a point at which, and I don't know exactly when it happened, but there was a point where I started to feel comfortable inventing material. Like, because obviously it's all based in the lore and where Tolkien's going with all this thing. But every once in a while, there's a scene that you need, or like the scene that I was talking about between Elrond and Elros, there's no description of that scene anywhere in any book ever.
Mm-hmm.
But they had to have had a discussion at some point.
Yeah, yeah.
About what's going on and who's doing what. And so... It was a little daunting at first, but the idea of did at some point say that he wanted that. At some point, he said that he wanted people to invest enough artistically in the world that he was creating to write stories and make music and draw painting, and, you know, and do all of that.
Well, that was before he read the Zimmerman script. He changed his mind.
That's fair. But, you know, at some point, this was something that he desired. And so,
I know, I had noticed that too early on in my studies, was that he said that. And I think he meant it back in the day, you know, because he had a very lofty idea of you know, what people would do with his story. And I think he was right in one respect.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, he ended up having some bad experiences with,
He did it to everything else he ever made contact with. So, you know, I think it sounds fair.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The subplot with Manwë, and I learned a lot about the character of Manwë from that little diversion of Manwë going to meet with Melkor.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Essentially the Nixon goes to China moment, right?
Right, mm-hmm. Right.
And now there was nothing, that, like none of that's in the book, but when the suggestion first came up and I started looking through the text and looking at Manwë's interactions with everybody all the way through, of course he would do that. Like, it makes perfect sense.
Yeah,
and all of a sudden,
absolutely.
I started to see Manwë as King of Arda in a completely different way than I had before.
Yeah, absolutely. The fleshing out of some of those characters, thinking through exactly that kind of situation. Like, given what he says and does in other places, he would have done something like this, right? And that's, you know, when your innovation is going in directions like that, it really makes the whole adaptation undertaking really satisfying.
I'm sorry, but this little hobbit over here, is Teresa off camera making him smile?
No, that's just Tim.
I think
he likes seeing himself on the webcam.
So he was smiling at himself. Yeah, that would have been just like mine as well. Yeah.
Also, one of his favorite things to do is to play with the keyboard. So.
Uh huh. Yes.
That's really trying to keep him from hitting Apple Q.
Oh
yes.
Yeah. No kidding.
Awesome. Hi, Wally. Good to see you, Wally. That's right. Yeah, so the Silmarillion Film Project is...
This podcast will still be going on when Corey's kids and my kids are, in their, middle age.
Exactly, yeah, yeah.
Well, you'll be holding your grandson, in a future
Exactly.
<webathon.
laughs> Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, very good. Okay, well, thanks everybody for joining me. I got a whole bunch of other things to do. Great talking with you guys. You guys in particular will be shocked to hear that I've been actually kind of running on schedule so far today. So
I can't believe it.
I was pretty amazed actually. When I got on, it's like, oh, he's about ready to wind up. That's pretty awesome.
I mean, I think you're 20 minutes behind, but all things
maybe it's us, Dave. It could be us.
It could be you.
He was on schedule for the one immediately before this. So.
Exactly. I wasn't going to point that out, but yeah, I was spot on. I was 3 minutes early for the previous segment, in fact. I'm just, that's the fact.
I'm going to blame the little girl.
There you go.
Professor, did you happen to mention to her that there was a moment in the Silm Film Project specifically geared to answer one of her questions from last time?
Oh, wait, which one? Oh, no, I forgot about that. Which?
The Ringwraiths crossing the river question.
Oh, yes.
Why they're afraid of water, and we found a way to answer that question. That question specifically inspired something in the Silm Film Project.
Right. Yeah, that's cool. Yeah, I did forget about that. Yeah, but that's right. I should bring that up.
She getting a special guest appearance on Silmarillion Film Project.
Hey,
there we go.
She's about ready. You know, I think. She's about ready for that. And Dave, I was wondering how long it would take before he started yanking your earbuds out. That seemed.
It's actually incredible. It took that long.
I was thinking the same.
The depth of his passion for the keyboard.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Very good. Okay. Very good. So thanks everybody for joining me. And I encourage people to join us on the Silm Film Project. We broadcast every other week, more or less, on Fridays. So Friday mornings at 10 a.m. is when we broadcast live. We're going to be...
This coming one.
Yeah, this coming one. Right. So we just did one yesterday, but that was a makeup. So we're doing one again back on our regular two-week schedule starting next Friday, the 20th. When we are actually going to do episode 3 of season 3 and start talking about the Beleriand story, what Thingol and Melian are doing and how we get to the raising of the Girdle of Melian and how all that stuff is going to happen. And we're going to have Ent battles and all kinds of things going on. The beginning of the Ent Orc feud will be occurring, not in episode 3, but soon thereafter. So definitely. Just a few episodes down the road. So definitely feel free to join us for that. And thanks everybody for being with us today. Wally is sad to go, which is too bad. Yeah. I'm sorry.
We know, buddy, but we can't keep the Tolkien professor off schedule. He's got to get back on schedule.
That's right. Absolutely. Thanks for joining me, everybody.
Bye, everybody.
Bet.
Take care.